Good morning. Today we're looking at the book of Esther. A couple of weeks ago I spoke on Ephesians, you'll remember, and the key message out of that was how under Christ, Jews and non-Jews, as we are brought together as one. So as we look at the book of Esther and this incredibly dramatic story that's of tremendous importance to the Jews, we should be able to identify with that as Christians because of the way that we are joined together with Jews under Christ. Esther's a curious book. It is on the one hand to the average Jew, probably the book that they know best and that is most popular among Jews. Throughout history it's a great source of encouragement as Jews have faced persecution. Each year during the festival of Purim, the book is read out loud in its entirety, twice. Once in the evening and then again the following morning. And yet on the other hand, it's interesting that it's a book in which God is not mentioned, not once. In fact, in the version that we have, it doesn't even mention prayer. But quite obviously the hand of God is right throughout this whole story. And we can take encouragement from the fact that throughout the thousands of years, obviously many godly people have really had an objective look at this book and asked the question, is it valid for it to be part of our scriptural canon? And why is it not, for example, with the Apocrypha, the books that are regarded as not being scriptural? This distinction is not something that just happens just mysteriously. These are decisions, concrete decisions that are made by real people through history. But Esther, the book of Esther, has withstood that test and those challenges. And it's encouraging, really, that we live today in an age that is somewhat more enlightened by archaeology and historical evidence. And in fact, we probably know a lot more about that time and about Xerxes than people centuries before us. And as is most often the case, or universally, in fact, the case with scriptural books, that inevitably the new information that comes to light just more and more reinforces the historical accuracy of these accounts. But we do need to be aware that there are some challenges. They're not entirely, they're not insurmountable, but we do need to be aware that, for example, Esther as a historical character is not really known outside of this account. This is about the only account of Esther. We know a lot about Xerxes, but apart from Xerxes, I see the other characters that apparently there's not really a lot of extra-biblical historical evidence. But that's not really a big problem. This story, really, in the scheme of history, is not a big deal. It's a fairly minor event. It's major and incredible significance to the Jews, but it's not surprising that it doesn't appear in other historical records. This is a polygamous society, and one can presume that Esther was probably one wife of many of Xerxes. That's just a little bit of the background and historical picture of this story. This book of Esther, as I mentioned, explains the Jewish feast of Purim that is directed at remembering this time. The King Xerxes, that's the Greek transliteration of his name, is also known commonly as Ahasuerus, which is a Hebrew transliteration of his Persian name or something like that. So in some Bibles you'll find he's referred to differently, but it's one and the same guy. It's just different names for the same person. He was described historically as a cruel, capricious and despotic man. Not a really nice fellow. So he has this big banquet, which is described in some detail, and suggests that one of the purposes was that he was actually getting his people together to plan war against the Greeks. But he calls Queen Vashti out and she defies his directive to come and present herself. She was very beautiful. It's not known why she defied him in this way. And so any suggestions of reasons as to why she did, it would seem are speculative. You can speculate on all sorts of reasons why she might have, but apparently there isn't really any evidence, concrete evidence, for her defiance. And so this causes a little bit of a fuss. And Xerxes' advisors suggest that he depose her and that he send out this edict. And so he did. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom in its own script and to each people in their own language, proclaiming that every man should be ruler over his own household using his own native tongue, which, when you think about it, was really a somewhat ludicrous edict to make, but that's sort of by the by. And then there's this story about them going out and gathering up all these beautiful young girls, and we can read this, and, you know, just like you're reading a fairy tale perhaps, and go, yeah, ho-hum. But this is real, this really did happen, and not just in this event, but it was common practice all through history in many of these rulers. And really is quite awful when you think about it. And I guess girls being beautiful can be a liability, and was certainly a little bit of a liability for Esther. Esther was an orphan. She was adopted by this guy Mordecai, who looked after her. And Esther wins favour with the king, and she's crowned queen. But all this time, she's maintaining this contact with Mordecai, and she is obedient to his directions. She doesn't protest. She does what she's told. She keeps her Jewishness to herself. Presumably, there would have been some issues about foods and things like that. We can draw a little bit of a contrast here to Daniel, who took a different approach, but that's really secondary. Now, there's this bit of a story about Mordecai. 2 verse 6, just an aside, says that being carried into exile from Jerusalem, that presumably is referring to his family, not Mordecai himself. He would have been something like in his 90s if it had been him personally. So presumably that's his family that it was referring to being taken into exile. And Mordecai uncovers this plot to assassinate the king. It seems that he was the gatekeeper, not an insignificant position apparently, and he was well connected with what was going on in the court. Xerxes apparently was finally bumped off by someone in this manner, but in this particular case, the plot was foiled. Esther reports the information to the king in Mordecai's name, which is quite significant. She lets him know that it's come from Mordecai, and that's recorded. They were obviously very particular about recording everything that went on, and it's unfortunate that we don't have more of those records from those days, those extensive records that they kept. And so that little detail obviously plays out as in significance later in the story. It's a significant detail. But then we get to this fellow Haman, this evil guy Haman. It says here that he was an Agagite, which would imply that he's a descendant of Agag in 1 Samuel 15, which in itself is very significant, because you remember the story of Saul supposed to wipe out Agag. Some commentary that I've read suggests that that's perhaps a little bit simplistic, because Agag apparently was not necessarily the person's personal name, but more of a title. So maybe Haman was a direct descendant of King Agag, but perhaps not. Regardless of that, he wanted all his people to bow down and pay him honour. But Mordecai wouldn't. That's a little bit curious and interesting in itself. We can really only sort of speculate about the whole circumstances here. From what we know about Haman and from what we know about Mordecai, there was obviously a major clash going on here. Two very strong characters. There's not necessarily a cultural reason why Mordecai wouldn't bow down. 2 Samuel 18:21, I've noted here, the Cushite bowed down before Joab and ran off. Jews bowing down before kings and leaders was not necessarily unusual in the Bible. However, it may have been that what Haman was demanding was essentially worship, and if that was the case, well then it would have been entirely proper for Mordecai to defy Haman. But regardless of all that, what we see here is clear-cut case of anti-Semitism. And by the way, Esther is the first book of the Bible where these people are referred to as Jews. Previously, they were just referred to as Hebrews or Israelites. And so from here on, referred to as Jews. And Haman knows that, finds out that Mordecai is a Jew. And he is obviously deeply anti-Semitic. And that fact is fascinating in a macabre sort of a way when you look at the history of anti-Semitism right through to the present day. And obviously most significantly under the Nazis and Hitler. And so what happens next, apart from what we know of more recent history, might seem to be somewhat perplexing. But my personal view, and this is just my personal analysis, is that there's a spiritual realm behind all this, which is really the devil wanting to thwart God's plans. And the Jews are God's people, and the Messiah is going to come through God's people, and the devil is always doing everything that he can to thwart God's plan, and the Jews are still God's people, and they're still part of his plan, and the devil is still trying to destroy the Jews. I mean, just this week, see all the publicity about Iran. Well, you know, what are the leaders of Iran wanting to do? Well, it's quite plain and clear. They've made their intentions very clear, what they're on about. So this guy Haman is obviously clearly anti-Semitic. And so he goes to the king. He doesn't give all the details. He leaves out certain details. And it fits with Xerxes' character of what we know about him from other accounts, when we see his nonchalance and indifference to the suggestion of just mass slaughter of a whole race of people. It fits with what we know about him. Haman offers a stupendous amount of money to the king. So he's basically wanting to buy the right to wipe out these people. And that's referred to again later by Esther, saying they've been sold for annihilation. In 3 verse 7, he casts this lot. And the Persians were superstitious, and Haman was no different. He wanted to choose a lucky day, so he cast a lot. But guess what? God is in charge of the outcome of that lot. Proverbs 16:33 says, "The lot is cast in the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." And as it was, the outcome, the date was some time in the future, which gave people like Mordecai some time to think and to pray and then finally to act and to react. Another point of note about Haman's presentation to the king, a lot of what he said was actually true, but he did lie outrightly, implying that the Jews were troublesome, which it seems that they weren't. Jeremiah 29:7 says also, "Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper." The Jews were faithful in this regard, and apparently they did prosper. So they weren't being troublesome, they weren't being rebellious. They were following what God had told them. So Mordecai obviously knows about this, but Esther, being cloistered in the confines of the court, is apparently oblivious to it all. And eventually he brings this to Esther's attention. And what he presents to her is really quite stark and brutal. But it's very, very clear. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back the answer, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish, and who knows but that you have come to a royal position for such a time as this." It's a very dramatic situation that he's suggesting, of course, that God will have his way. God's plans will come to fulfillment. But Esther has been put in a position where she has the opportunity to be part of God's plan. And she can choose whether or not she is going to take up that opportunity. But either way, she's in a very perilous position. She can't just go to the king, her husband, remember, any time she chooses. Remember the character of this man. He would think nothing of executing her at the drop of a hat for some slight, such as coming into his presence uninvited. Esther's response is very commendable. She's not impulsive, but she asks for fasting, which naturally would have included prayer. And by the way, I'll mention as well too that the version of Esther that we have before us in our Bible lines up with the Hebrew canon, but there are other records that add in certain bits and verses, but they are largely discounted as not being part of the original. So Esther asks for the people to respond to fast. And she plays the situation very carefully in chapter 5. It's a very grave situation. There is time to take it carefully, and that's something to note. Remember also that Esther is probably very young. The strategy that she follows at first glance might seem a bit strange. Why didn't she just go up and ask him, you know, and say, hey, look, you know. But it's just not that simple when you appreciate everything that it brings to bear on the case. So she invites Haman and the king to eat together. Haman just thinks this is wonderful. But obviously on the first occasion, Esther, through whatever means, her intuition or through the Holy Spirit, just knows that the time is not right. But it seems obviously that the king has enough discernment to know that she wants something and she's going to ask for something, and he's wanting to know what it is. So we also have this in between these two meals. We have the situation where the king can't sleep. And this is one of these things where those who would cast aspersions on the accuracy of this book would say, well, look, this is all just too much coincidence. And I suggest there's two different ways that historical books can be judged with regards to their accuracy and whether they're part of the canon or not. And one of those is the proper objective approach, which I believe is why certain accounts have been left out of the canon as not being properly accurate and not being completely from God. But I'd suggest that if you read a lot of the background about some of these things, just so much of it, to my view, just simply comes from what is almost an atheistic view that tries to write God out of the picture. Things that might seem to be coincidences, well, if you don't believe in the power of God, you might say, well, they're improbable. But if God is God, well, then nothing is improbable or impossible. If God is in charge of things, then he can do what he likes. So God is in charge of things, and we can presume that it was God that brought this turn of events about. He was turning Haman's incredible sin towards God's own advantage and purposes without God himself being tainted by that sin. So back to the story. Xerxes can't sleep and he asks for the records to be read. It's a bit strange to be like waking up in the night saying, oh, can someone read me Hansard, you know, record of proceedings in Parliament? I can't sleep, you know. And they read on, and they come to this story about Mordecai saving the king. And I think this is a reflection of the character of Mordecai, given the fairly unsavoury nature of this guy Xerxes, that Mordecai puts himself out to save his life. But he is the king after all, and I would say that Mordecai was following that command to seek the peace and prosperity of the city, so forth. So it's noted that Mordecai hadn't been rewarded, so the king decides, right, okay, I want to reward this fellow, what am I going to do? Well, he goes out into the court, and this guy Haman's really fired up, so he's out there early, and he's got no idea what's going on, and so the king says to him, what should I do for the man I want to honour? Haman thinks that the king's talking about him, and he's not, he's talking about his mortal enemy. The king, of course, is obviously blithely unaware of this feud between Haman and Mordecai. And so Haman is just totally devastated and humiliated by having to honour Mordecai in a way that presents him sort of virtually almost as the king, you know, on a horse that's dressed up in a crown, etc., and taking through the streets. Now, in 6:13, it's noted that he told his friends and his wife and his advisers, and they said, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. He will surely come to ruin. Haman's friends were superstitious, but they did correctly note that no one prospers who plots against the Jews. They seemed to recognise that, and they knew something about history and the God of the Jews. And I'd suggest we can draw some encouragement the same is true today for people who even today are not that much different to Haman. In fact, come from the same part of the world. So the story continues. Esther puts her case before the king. The king is obviously very much favourably disposed now towards Esther and also towards Mordecai. because he's been reminded that Mordecai was responsible for saving his life, even though up until this point Haman had obviously been his favourite. So Esther presents a case that, look, you've sent out an edict that's going to wipe out me and my people, so on and so forth. And Xerxes is furious about this, and he does what most people would do if they're highly emotionally charged up, and that is he gets up and he strides out of the room to cool down a bit. And when he comes back, there's Haman, obviously, probably, you know, on the floor, clasping it at Esther's feet. And Xerxes, it seems, misreads the situation. You can imagine, in the very highly charged situation that it is, Esther's in no position to correct the king as to his misjudgment of the situation. Regardless, it might be suggested that, you know, the proper thing would have been to have done that, but if you picture the situation, it just wouldn't have been proper. So Haman is sent off to be executed. There's a bit of an exchange that occurs, and some inquiries are made, and the instruction is given to impale him on the pole that he had intended for Mordecai. So, hurrah, you think. Okay, this is all very wonderful that the evil man has been executed. And Psalm 9, verse 16, the wicked are ensnared by the works of their hands. But the story's not over. There is still this edict out there in force to wipe out the Jews. And so there is more work to be done. Esther still has a job to do. And so she again comes to the king to ask that something be done about this. There's not really any other records that suggest that the laws of the Medes and Persians were irrevocable as such. But you can probably sort of picture the situation in that they were very proud people. They wouldn't want to admit that their law was somehow inadequate. And besides, just with all the machinery of state and in any organisation, it can be difficult to annul some edict that's been given. So he takes a different approach and basically allows them to have another edict written, which gives the Jews the right to defend themselves. And so 8 verse 17, in every province and in every city to which the edict of the king came, there was joy and gladness among the Jews with feasting and celebrating. This was obviously the start of where this Purim festival came from. But note, very importantly, and many people of other nationalities became Jews because the fear of the Jews seized them. So you can see what God's doing. There's this terrible evil in the world, and God has turned it around for his own purposes, for winning people into his kingdom. And so even in the most darkest of circumstances, we just never know how God is going to use the evil of the world to further extend his kingdom. And the story goes on a little bit. 9 verse 13, Esther says, if it pleases the king, give the Jews and Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow, and let Haman's 10 sons be impaled on poles. Just because it's recorded in the Bible doesn't necessarily mean that it is commendable action on the part of the person. It wasn't necessarily a directive from God. This really, I'd suggest, is rather vindictive and perhaps not really excusable. It may have been right and proper, don't really know, but it's not necessarily something that we can, take direction from. So Mordecai is elevated to pretty much the highest official position in the land and becomes a very powerful person. And you can see from his conduct prior to this that he was obviously a very, very capable person. Now back to the records outside of the Bible, what is noted is that there's a collection of tablets from the reign of Artaxerxes I and Darius II that mentions more than 100 Jewish names in connection with important positions in the realm. And apparently this would not have been true under Darius I, as this succession of Persian kings. So in between was, guess who? This guy Xerxes. And it has been suggested, and this is just speculation, but it's been suggested that Mordecai was responsible for that change. So there's all these little bits of information that can be gleaned from other historical records that all point to this story, this account, I should say. And so it may have been a tremendous turning point in the fortunes of the Jews in that area and their prominence. So what can we take away and remember from the Book of Esther? Well, lots and lots of things, obviously. A couple of points that I would point out. One is that if Haman's plan had succeeded, bear in mind that these events occur between Ezra 6 and 7. So if you're reading Ezra, between chapter 6 and 7 is where this account is. So if Haman's plan had succeeded, there would not have been any Nehemiah. Nehemiah would never have been written. Nehemiah wouldn't have existed. And more importantly, there would have been no Christ. So that's very important. But obviously God wasn't going to let this happen, as Mordecai alludes in that chapter 4, verse 14. God was ultimately in control, and the devil wasn't going to thwart God's plans. The Jews, by the way, did not deserve God's favour any more than any of us do. God's plan in this regard is not because of the right things that the Jews have done. It's in spite of them. God does these things because it's his sovereign choice that he chooses to intervene. And it's the same for all of us. So that's the first point, is how critical this story is. Here we've got a guy who had the power, who was in the position and had the motive to literally wipe out the Jews, because the Persian Empire was an absolutely vast empire, and most of the Jews, if not all, would have been living within that empire. So the second thing is that even today, the Jews face the threat of powerful individuals who have set their sights on destroying them. And the same issue was occupying the attention of those people 2,500 years ago is still occupying the attention of people today. Even world leaders, not just the Jews in Israel, are worried about these things. I can tell you even Barack Obama, I'm sure, is concerned about people who would want to wipe out Israel. But we know the outcome already. We already know the outcome of the future because God is in charge. And that's probably the key thing that I would leave you with. Just that assurance and peace that we can have in knowing that whatever the darkest situations, God is in charge and our duty is to submit to him. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we do truly thank you that you are just master over all of history and master over the whole world.